In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light, so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, or of the will of the flesh, or of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. John testified to him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks ahead of me, because he was before me.' From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known."
Invite all the children to come and join me in the front, please. Along with Kim Norman. Well, good morning, good morning. How are you? Yeah, I usually like it when Michael does the time with the children, because he's so interesting. He's got so many great ideas to talk with you about. Let's take our... Oh, look at him. He's sitting up. He's so cute. The reason I asked Ms. Kim to be here this morning is that she is a math teacher, and don't hold that against her. I wish I had Ms. Kim as a math teacher in high school, but she teaches over... at Cal State Fullerton, and she's a very smart person. And I brought her up here because I wanted her to talk about numbers and how important numbers are. And Kim, what's the important number for little John here?
714.
And when does he turn one? 714, 15. That's so the number one is a good celebration, right? When you have a baby. And then for you, what's an important number for you? 11. Is that how old you are or want to be, or is that just that's your golden birthday? Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. When I was about your age, I always looked forward to being 13. That was an age of a teenager, and I wanted to be a teenager. And then once I experienced the disappointment of being a teenager, I thought 21 would be a good number, because then I would be an adult, right? But when I was in high school, 18 was a very important number, because that's when you had to go register for the draft. For the military. So I had to do that when I turned 18. 16 is a good number too, right? Because then you get to learn how to drive, and you get to experience a little bit of freedom there. Another number that was really important in the life of this church is the number 100, because we turned 100 years old last year, and we celebrated that. It was a big deal. So Ms. Kim, what's your favorite number? 56. And do you have any reason for that, or just...
Well, it's really cool, and it's also 56 is a really cool number, and it is 7 times 8, which is also really cool.
I know. How can you argue with a preference, right? Yeah. Anybody else have a favorite number?
Seven.
Yes, that's an important number, isn't it? Yeah. Is that a lucky number for you? You've always liked the number 7, yeah. Uh-huh. For some people, it's 13, because 13 can be kind of a superstitious number, because if you go up an elevator, sometimes tall buildings don't have a 13th floor because they're a little superstitious. They have floor 11, and then floor 12, and then 14. They just skip 13 altogether. If it's Friday the 13th, so Friday the 13th for your friend who was born on that day, it's kind of a lucky day for her then, right? Yeah. What can we do with numbers, Ms. Kim? Everything's made up of numbers. Yep. Everything is mathematical. It's geometrical. And it took human beings a long time to figure out a lot of that stuff and how important mathematics is. Zero had to be invented, I know. That was a big philosophical debate for a long time, the number zero. Yeah, the number zero. So there is a long history about numbers, and the reason I wanted to talk about numbers is because the number 40 is a real important number in the Bible. So is the number 7. So I don't know, maybe Kristen, that's a number for creation for you. In the Bible, it's the number for creation. And God created the world in 7 days. And does anybody have a favorite number as 3? All right, yes, 3. That's the number of mystery. That's why we have the Trinity. And that's always a mystical kind of a number. Does anybody know what the number 40 stands for in the Bible? 40. Well, let's see. It rained for 40 days when Noah was in his ark, right? The people of Israel were in the wilderness for 40 years, right? Jesus was out in the wilderness for 40 days, right? So 40 is kind of a number for testing. So that's why the number 40 is important for the season of Lent, which began on Wednesday. So Lent is 40 days long from Ash Wednesday to Easter Sunday, if you don't count the Sundays. It's 40 days. So all of these numbers are very, very important. It's okay if he ties my shoelaces together. That's been done at my home before, so many, many times. I'm used to that. So let's all bow our heads for a word of prayer. Now, loving God, we're thankful for each season that comes along, and right now we're just beginning the season of Lent, and we know that the number 40 is very important in the season of Lent because it's a time of testing, a time of trial. It makes us think about our lives and helps us make decisions about what to do with our lives that are good for us. And so, loving God, we know that you're with us in so many different ways, and we know that you are with us during this time of 40 days. We pray these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Yes, when I was studying philosophy back in college, mathematics was a big part of philosophy from the very beginning. A lot of the early philosophers thought that the whole universe was a mathematical construction, and there was the idea of the harmony of the spheres. And there were certain frequencies that were more important than other frequencies, and numbers, some more important than others. And there was this very elegant understanding of just how the world just sort of works together like it does. So I thought it was very... I'm not a mathematician, so I don't get that. But I'll throw a number at you, though. 2 billion. That's a lot. That's how many Muslims there are in the world. It depends on who you talk to. It's hard to count, of course. Some think it's 2.1 billion up to 2.8 billion. There are also about 2 billion Christians in the world. And again, that's a little hard to calculate, anywhere between 2.1 and 2.8 billion Christians. And so those two religions make up a large share of the religions of the world. I think Hinduism is the next one down, and there are a lot fewer Hindus than there are Christians or others. And then there are other religions down the scale. The reason I bring this up is because I wanted to make a few comments about President Obama's recent speech about trying to define what an Islamic act is in reference to terrorism. Of course, he wants to make the political point that we are not at war with Islam, which I think is important to bear in mind. And then there's a lot of criticism of the words that he chose because people want to say, well, that terrorism comes right out of their own scriptures. And so, yes, it's a militant Islam. It's a destructive Islam, but it's still Islam. And, of course, the president is trying to make the distinction between those who abuse their religion and those who and those who embody it and honor it. And he's also made comments along the way that we Christians also have a history of extremism in some cases and terrorism in other cases. So he kind of waded into a no-win argument, I think. And I mention these comments because we've talked before about what is a Christian act and what isn't. And I think there are many acts that are done in the name of Christianity that you can't call Christian. Like you can kill someone in the name of God, but that's not a Christian act. And we can go down the list. You can't steal in the name of God and try to justify it in that way and call it an act of God. It's not an act of God. It's not a Christian act. And so I think as we look at Islam and Christianity together, I think we can say the same about Islam, is that killing other people is not an Islamic act in the same way that killing people is not a Christian act, even though they come from a certain point of view. We have to keep in mind that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all come from the same source. They're all people of the book. And we have to remind ourselves that all three of those religions come from areas where tribalism was the social organization of the day. And if you read the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, you get a very strong sense of tribalism. It's one tribe over against another, and they're often fighting one against the other, and each tribe has their own god. And Israel was one tribe, and it, of course, broke into 12 other tribes. That's why we call them the tribes of Israel. They're tribal. And so each tribe has their own god, and they would often bring that god into war with them against another tribe. And that's how they portrayed the validity of their god, is that if they took their god into battle with them in form of a flag or an icon or something like that. And if they won, that meant God was on their side. And if they lost, well, that meant that the other side's God won. So we get a lot of that in the Bible, this sort of back and forth, tit for tat, my God against your God. And even with some of the most famous prophets in the Old Testament, we talked about Elijah last time. There's a kind of a humorous but weird story about Elijah representing Yahweh and other prophets representing Baal. And, of course, they were going to have a little contest on the mountaintop. And, you know, whose God could set this, this sacrificial mound of wood on fire? And so it went back and forth, and it's a little silly in the way that we look at it. And so by the time it came to Elijah, of course, the god Baal could not do it. And Elijah says, well, you know, pour some water on the wood. And he said, well, do it again. Pour more water on it, you know, making it more difficult. And of course, Yahweh was able to set it on fire. That's the kind of tribal thinking that our religion comes from. And we have the same problem as the Muslims have and the Jewish people have. And that is that our religion is founded upon principles that we no longer hold to be true and helpful. So this idea of one tribe against another is a very destructive idea. I think that's why President Obama wanted to put a distance between our conflict as being between Christianity and Islam. And he's trying to disconnect the terrorist act by not calling them Islamic acts. I understand that. And there's a political necessity about that, even though it's not entirely true. Because we have acts of violence that are done by Yahweh that are quite shocking. And there are stories about that in the Bible. And that's what atheists often point to. You know, what kind of a God are you folks worshiping when, you know, they pick and choose a variety of stories in the Old Testament, and there's not a whole lot we can say about that, except for the fact that that's the way the world was back when those texts were written. And all the more important, then, that when we come to Jesus, there really is a huge break from tribal thinking. And I think that it's hard for us to understand that because we don't live in a tribal world, not in this country necessarily. But the Middle East is still tribal. Afghanistan is still a collection of tribes, as is Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And you just go down the list of Middle Eastern countries, they are still organized tribally. And I think it's a mistake for us to try to impose our sense of democracy, which has taken centuries to develop, and impose that on them through violence, by the way, and thinking that we can, you know, presto, create a democratic society. But here we have a text. I chose this text from the Gospel of John because I think it's important to keep in mind the separation between Jesus and Christ and what we're talking about when we talk about Jesus and what we talk about Christ. This text, the prologue to the Gospel of John, is usually offered during the season of Christmas, right after Christmas, because it's a creation piece of poetry. In fact, the beginning words, "In the beginning was the Word," are designed to make us think of Genesis. You know, in the beginning, God. In the beginning, the Word. So, right off the bat, the author of the Gospel of John is wanting us to think of creation when he is going to now begin to describe who Jesus is and why Jesus is so important to humanity. And here we are 2,000 years later, and we still don't quite get it. They might have had a better handle on it back then than we do now, because they were fighting off this whole tribalist, you know, mentality, and they were in the thick of it, and they knew what the stakes were, and they knew what the coming of the Messiah meant to them. And it's very different. So for us to try to understand that tribal milieu that the gospel comes out of, it's a very, very powerful thing when we understand that. And so it is a point of creation, and it's a very simple point that the author of the Gospel of John is trying to do. And it's at the very beginning, of course, and we've heard these words before, and sometimes I feel like I'm in a calculus class trying to memorize theorems and axioms and all these things because it gets so technical. The language is very technical. It's poetic. It's beautiful. But the technicality of it kind of hinders us from understanding what John is trying to do here. And it says, "In the beginning was the Word, the Logos, which, by the way, logos in those days, in the understanding of philosophers, were just the cosmic principle of order. It's the ground of meaning, the source of purpose. So the logos is what holds everything together, like math. You know, a mathematician will describe the world in such a way that is very elegant and it's all held together. And so there's this principle that John is pointing to, the word, the logos, that created everything. So the claim is that the logos created everything. The language is a little mushy here in the Revised Standard Version, because the logos and God are not necessarily the same thing. They're closely tied. It says that the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, it's a little muffled there because it's not as strongly connected in this version. He, meaning the Logos, was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life. Now, that's the point of the whole gospel, is John is going to try to show why Jesus, who became the Christ, was so closely identified with Christ that he is the embodiment of the power of God, the Logos, the Christ, in our midst. And it's all about creating life. And then he talks about what came into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. Now, our tendency is to mystify this and make it about another world. John is speaking about this world. And I don't need to make the case to all of you that we live in somewhat of a darkened world, where tribalism is still very strong, where violence is still very strong, trying to solve problems through revenge is still a huge problem, and the use of violence to gain a peaceful end is contradictory. So there is this idea that this light is coming into a dark world. And this light is meant to illuminate the world. And what is this light except that the logos, that is the creativity of God, can be embodied in a person? Now, later on, of course, he makes the claim that in verse 10, he was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. So what John is beginning with is not only the statement about why he thinks Jesus is important, but what the problem is as well. His own people didn't accept him as the Messiah. That was a big problem for them. In verse 12, but to all who receive him, who believe in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of human beings, but of God. So what we are talking about here is a new creation. And we are talking about human beings living here in this world. It is about a new human race that is possible. So Christ, in the Gospel of John, is another word for logos. And we've talked about Christ here before, and that is simply the creative power of God. That's what it is, Christ. And that's why in other parts of the Bible, it could say that Christ was with God at the very beginning. Now, some people say, well, how can Jesus be at the very beginning of things? Well, it's not talking about Jesus. It's talking about Christ. Christ is not Jesus' last name, as I keep referring to. It's a title. It's a name that we give to God's creative power. And we see that on display here. That's why the author of John wants to link it so closely to Genesis, because what God is doing is a new thing in Jesus. And so what happens here is that Jesus embodies Christ, this power of God, so well that he becomes the model, the example of what it looks like for a human being to fully embody Christ. So that's why those two words become very, very close together, Jesus and Christ. So when we say Jesus Christ, we are making that link between the man Jesus and the creative power of God. And what John is claiming is that people don't get that, not even his own people. And we could still say that about the church today. People in Christianity often talk about Jesus being alive, Jesus as being there from the very beginning, Jesus being the creator of all things. So Christianity has really mixed those two terms up in such a way that it becomes silly after a while. If we are sort of forced to believe that Jesus was with God at the very beginning of creation, that's such a silly idea that we're asked to accept that on faith. I don't even know what that means. It doesn't mean anything that Jesus was with God at the very beginning. Christ was. And so I think it's very important to keep these two things separate, because if we put them together in the way Christianity normally puts them together, then Christ becomes inaccessible to us. And so we say we have to trust Jesus in order to connect ourselves with Christ, when in fact Christ is embodying the power of, Jesus is embodying the power of Christ to such an extent that Jesus is saying, you also can embody Christ. And that's what the reference is here to making all of us children of God. So Jesus is not in a separate category from us. And John is going to show why he was so special, because this is what it looks like to be fully embodied by Christ. Here's Jesus, his life. The claim is, he embodies Christ, and this is what it looks like to embody Christ. And so we get the first story, the story of turning water into wine, which is often misunderstood. That is about transforming power. That's what that story is all about. It's a very quiet story. It goes on, and hardly anybody in the wedding party knows what happens. We know as the reader. But as I've said before, that focus on the creative power of God being right in the middle of life gets turned up throughout the Gospel of John, so that by the time you get to the resurrection of Jesus, you make the connection that, yes, that is a transforming power of God, but so are all the other smaller events that happen in Jesus' life. That's why I think it's a little silly to look for the historical Jesus. You know, there's another program coming out, Faith, Fact, Fabrication, or something like that is the is the teaser. And people have tried for 150 years to look for the historical Jesus, and I think it's interesting. You know, you can be historical about it and learn a lot of things, but it all misses the point that the writer of the Gospel of John is trying to make. And that is that Jesus is used as an example. You can treat it as a parable. Now, how historical can you be with a parable? You know, treating a parable as a historical happening just goes against the very idea of what a parable does. So I think it makes more sense to take Jesus and his life, death, and resurrection as a parable about how God's power works not only in his life, but our life as well. Now, there is the claim in the Gospel of John that we can trust that power in our own lives to such an extent that by trusting it, we embody it. Now, Christianity often has taken away all of these reasons for embodying Christ. Early on, the Christian church got way off track when they tried to think about philosophically about Jesus the man and Christ as being part of God being in the same person, because they had this thing called substance philosophy. You know, you had stuff here and you had stuff over here, and they can't occupy the same place. And so a lot of the early creeds focused on trying to come up with this idea of Trinity using substance philosophy, and it just got them into this sort of twisted, you know, mental game that they played for centuries, and people lost their lives over it. But we no longer see the world made of stuff that bumps into other stuff. We see a world where there are relationships, there are not stuff, and so other people and other things can become part of who we are. So there is that internal relationship that others can enter into us and become part of us. That makes a lot more sense to me, because that's what love does. You know, we open ourselves to another person, they become part of us. And that's what John is talking about. It's the author of John is talking about Jesus before all the substance language gets used. So we're trying to go before that and just seeing that it is very possible for the divine to become part of us. That's what it means to be a child of God. Now, what that looks like, well, we see it in the life of Jesus. He's the example. He's the pioneer. He's the sort of the first one that we follow. And that's why it was such a powerful thing when it was when it happened 2,000 years ago. It was because it was a way out of violence. It was a way out of the domination system. It was a way out of revenge and all that kind of stuff, because that's what the world was. One God fighting another God. And so this was the way out. This was the good news, is that you could embody the creative power of God to such an extent that you can be infused with this power of creativity yourself. You can be a child of God. And I think that's the whole point of the Gospel of John, is to make us realize that we all can become children of God in this way. Now, at a minimal level, we're all children of God because we are simply created in the image of God. But then there's this other idea of being born anew, born again, into this other level of knowing that if we are open to being influenced by the Spirit of God in this present moment, then we can become, then that Christ, that creative power can become part of us. So that's why we want to disconnect the two terms, Jesus and Christ, because they're not the same, and then put them together intentionally as Jesus embodying Christ. So when we say Jesus Christ, that's what we mean. Now, there should be lots of Christs out there. Lots. And that's what the Apostle Paul was trying to do, is to create churches and communities where Christs would be created. People would claim this power for their own life, and it would be a transforming power, and it would be a hopeful power. It's the power of life, is what John is saying. And so when we come here on Sunday mornings, that's who we worship, is not Jesus, but Christ as embodied in Jesus. That's who we sing hymns to, and it's very important that we get the name right. Christ is the one we worship, not Jesus. But we see Christ embodied in Jesus so fully that we see the two together. They are not meant to be exceptionally put together. The point is that we all can become Christ in this way. That's the whole point. So when you make Jesus God, like Christianity has done, how is it possible to be like Jesus if Jesus is God? So that's part of the problem Christianity has had for 2,000 years, is this sort of, you know, not being able to put the two together. But when in fact the Gospel of John does that very fact, and he begins with the transformation of water into wine. That's how God's power works. So I don't know if this helps make any more sense of the prologue to the Gospel of John, but I think it's important to bear this distinction in mind at the beginning of Lent, because we think about our own lives during this time. We're a little bit more introspective. And what would it be like if we kind of realize that it's possible for us to embody Christ in our own lives, and it makes a difference? And how do we do that? Well, we look at Jesus. And how do we claim that? Well, we just trust it, and that's where trust comes in. So through our prayers, through our meditation, through the way that we choose to behave in the world, how we treat other people, that is a result of our embodiment of Christ. That's why I say, if you call yourself a Christian and you hurt another person on purpose, that's not a Christian act, and that goes against the Christ in you. Anyway, I'll stop talking about that now. I think that's enough. Point being, we are all children of God, more or less. And when the more fully we embody Christ in our own lives, the more fully we experience life. That's the claim. You want more life? You need more Christ. That's the formula, I guess. More life, more Christ. Let us bow our heads for a word of prayer. Loving God, we come here on this beginning of the season of Lent, and we are very aware of how difficult the world is, how darkness manifests itself in so many different ways in the world, and how it affects our own lives. And loving God, we know that you love us. You have created us for life. You have created us to be your children. And so, loving God, we ask that you would help us to open our hearts, our minds, to invite the power of Christ into our lives, your power, the creative power, that power that can transform water into wine, hatred into love, violence into peace, death into life. And so, loving God, without that power, there would be nothing. And with that power, there is life. And we thank you for that life. We thank you for Jesus in the way that he embodied that power to such an extent that we know how it works by seeing him. And we keep your prayer before us, the prayer that Jesus taught his own disciples how to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen.